Continue on this morning. We're going to look at a decision that I think a lot of people make. Maybe don't even realize they make it. It's a bad decision in one way, and I want to try to help you make it a little bit more beneficial than normally it really can be and is. Because I believe that some decisions you make are contagious. That is, if you make a decision, then you may influence somebody else to make the very same decision that you make. Because I have found that people basically are copycats. If you do a thing, chances are somebody else is going to do it to imitate you. Because we are copycats, you hear the cry very often, everybody does it. Well, why does everybody do it? We like sometimes so that other folks make decisions for us. Now this morning, I'm going to begin by doing something I seldom ever do. I'm going to give a test, not out loud, and you don't stand up and you don't wave your hand if you know the answer. But anyway, for those of you who are Bible scholars, and in the past when we have looked at various individuals in the Bible, as to the decision that they made, whether good or bad, you were familiar with that individual. Everyone knows who Jonah is or Daniel is. You know who these people are. This morning I'm going to talk about a decision that was made by a number of men. They all made the same decision. And I'm going to give you their names, and chances are you're not going to know any of these men. And they all made the same decision. Here's the names: Shamu, Shaphat, Igal, Palti, Gadiel, Gadai, sounds like an outer space show, doesn't it? Aniel, Sether, Nabai, and Gil. Anybody know who those guys are? Well, I wouldn't have known either if I hadn't written a sermon this morning. All these men made a decision that influenced a nation to make the very same decision they did. And you know, the Bible never has anything to say good about any of these men that I have named. What were they? They were all pessimists. All of them were pessimists. Now, I've been told, and I have read, that people are more likely to follow an optimist, and they're more likely to turn a deaf ear to a pessimist. The optimist, I am told, is preferred because he inspires enthusiasm, and the pessimist inspires gloom. No one likes gloom. Everyone likes excitement. So the optimist is always in, and the pessimist is always out. The optimist strikes up the band, and the pessimist rains on the parade. Nobody likes a rained-on parade. Everybody likes the band. So the conclusion is, from what I read, everybody loves an optimist, and they loathe a pessimist. I've got a question for you. If that's the way you believe, if that is true, why are most people pessimists? Why are most people filled with gloom and doom? Why are most people so sad? Why are most people heard complaining? Why do the newspapers primarily dwell only on that which is negative? You wouldn't think they would sell a one. If optimism is in and pessimism is out, hasn't someone told our newspapers about it? Why are there so many sour forecasters and predictions made every day, almost, from our news sources? If optimism is the thing to be, why are so many people on drugs? And then why fill our TV news with people who are sad and people who are mad? And you hardly ever see anybody on television that's glad. Now you look at the screen. You don't see much recorded on the news programs that's glad to hear about it. It seems as though people are saying, optimism is what everybody wants, but nobody does. Now, do you think people would always rather be around an optimist than a pessimist? That people would always want to follow the optimist and resist following the pessimist? Do you think that negative people really turn the majority off and that positive people always turn the crowd on? Now, I'm not going to argue or debate the merits of that kind of philosophy. But I want to say that the men that I named to you a while ago influenced a crowd. They influenced the nation, and they, every one of them, were pessimists. And in that crowd, there were two men that were optimists, and I didn't give you their names. But the crowd didn't follow the optimists, the crowd followed the pessimists. The two that I did not name that's going to identify the group for you, one was Caleb, and the other was Joshua. You say, oh, I know what you're talking about now. The 12 spies that Moses sent out to spy out the land of Canaan before Israel was going to go and take it as their promised land. Two optimists, 10 pessimists, and the people preferred to listen to and follow the advice of and copy the decision of the pessimists. This, to me, is one place where the philosophy is wrong. People do not always want to follow the optimist crowd, but instead, here we find the pessimist won out. There were only two, and I don't know if this is a correct phrase or not, there were only two cheer-uppers among the 12. I might go on and say there were only two optimists in the entire nation of Israel. You know, it's pretty bad when you only have two people in the entire population that's optimistic. And that's what you have here. Now, if you have your Bible, let's look at the book of Numbers. And the 13th chapter, and we're going to read a few more verses than normal. Start with verse 1 and go to 3 because 4... I believe 4 through 15 names of men I told you about a while ago. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, send thou men, that they may search the land of Canaan, which I give unto the children of Israel. Of every tribe of their fathers you shall send one man, and the one you send, now notice, will be a ruler among them. See, well, a pessimist never will make it to the top. One did here. Nobody's going to like or follow a pessimist. They did here. 10 tribes selected 10 pessimists to be their leader. Now, that's what you have here. And Moses, by the commandment of the Lord, sent them from the wilderness of Paran. Now, notice, he sent men who were heads of the children of Israel. Isn't it strange that God would ask for pessimists to go and spy out the land? That's what they are. You don't change your attitude overnight. I mean, optimists are optimists today. They're optimists tomorrow. They're optimists next year. They're optimists 10 years from now. And a pessimist the same way. I'm not a pessimist today and an optimist tomorrow. Now, these men were pessimistic by nature. And it's going to be likely if you send out a pessimist to spy out the land, he's not going to bring back a favorable report. He's not going to bring back some encouraging news. He's going to be looking on the black side of things when he goes. He's going with a negative attitude. And God said, send out the leaders knowing they were pessimists. All but two of them. Now let's go to verse 17. So there's room in God's family for folks that are negative. Let's go on though. Verse 17. And Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan and said unto them, get you up this way southward and go up into the mountain and see the land, what kind of land it is. Notice the people that dwell therein. See if they be strong or if they be weak. If they be few or if they be many, our voice is changing today, all right? And what the land is that they dwell in, whether it be good land or bad land, what the cities are like, how many dwell therein? Do they live in tents or do they live in fortified cities? And what the land is it fertile soil or is it poor soil? Is there wood there or is there not trees there? And be of good courage. Huh? Be optimistic. Be energetic. Be enthused. Man, that's hard to do if you're pessimist. But it's not impossible. It's not impossible. And bring me back some fruit from the land, because it was the time when the grapes were getting ripe in the land. All right? Now verse 25. And they returned from searching the land after being there 40 days. And they came to Moses and to Aaron and to all the congregation of the children of Israel. All right? And they brought back word unto them, to all the congregation, and they showed them the fruit of the land. And they told them, we came to the land where you sent us, and it does flow with milk and honey. And here is some fruit as proof. Nevertheless, the people be strong that dwell in the land. That wasn't an exaggeration, and that was not a lie. That is realism. That's not pessimism. That's realism. And the cities are walled. They were saying, we're going to have some problems. Well, that's not being pessimistic to say we're going to have some problems. Optimistic folks face problems. And the cities be great. And moreover, we saw there some children of Anak. Well, I don't know much about the Anak, but the Amalekites dwell in the land of the south, and the Hittites and the Jebusites. There's some more problems. You say these are just problems. And the Canaanites dwell by the sea. Now, Caleb, our man of optimism. And Caleb, now the people started getting itchy. This was not good news, but it wasn't bad news. It was disturbing news, but all of us face disturbing news. So let's don't say anything bad about any of them yet. They just told it like it was. And Caleb stilled the people because I believe they began to express great fear. And said, optimism, let us go up at once and take the land, for we are able to overcome it. Now he's talking to a crowd of people who are fearful. He's telling a crowd of pessimists, we can be overcomers. I believe most of the people in life you deal with are pessimists who need to be overcomers. I really do. Not many folks are like Caleb. All right? But, now the sad story. But the men that went up with Caleb said, and I believe they said the wrong thing. They said the wrong thing. They could have said, it's not going to be easy, friends. It's not going to be a piece of cake. It's going to be hard, but we can do it. Just like Caleb says. We can do it, but we'll have to overcome. All right. But they didn't say that. They didn't say that. We will not be able to go up against the people. Now there's pessimism taking hold. For they are stronger than we are, and they brought up an evil report of the land which they had searched, the children of Israel, saying, the land which we have gone to search is a land that eats up the inhabitants thereof, and all the people that we saw in it are men of great stature. And there we saw the giants, the sons of Anak, which come of the giants, and we are in our own sight as grasshoppers. And so would we be in their sight. Now, what was the end result of this report of the ten? Verse 1, chapter 14. And all the congregation lifted up their voice, and they wept. And the people wept all night long. Talk about disturbed, being upset, moaning and groaning. And the children of Israel murmured against Moses and against Aaron, and the whole congregation, only two optimists in the whole nation, and the whole congregation said, would God, better had God let us die in the land of Egypt, or had been better for God to let us have died in the wilderness than for him to have brought us unto this spot where we will fall by the sword and our wives and our children shall be taken captives. Were it not better for us even now to go back to Egypt? And they said one to another, let us find ourselves another leader and let us return to Egypt, because Moses not going to go with us. Now, how did God react to this pessimism? Look at the 26th verse of chapter 14. And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, how long shall I put up with this evil congregation which murmur against me? I have heard the murmurings of the children of Israel, which they murmur against me. Say unto them, as truly as I live, saith the Lord, so will I do this to them. Their carcasses shall fall in this wilderness, and all that were numbered of you according to your whole number, from 20 years old upward, which have murmured against me, they shall not be allowed to go into the land of promise. I swear this, except Caleb and Joshua. Okay? Now, a verse that quickly comes to mind before passing on here is Hebrews 11:6. That's all the Bible we're going to read this morning. Hebrews 11:6. Without faith, it is impossible to please God. Without faith, it is impossible to please God. I have to say this. Any decision that you might make that you find will harm your faith must be a bad decision. All right? Now, the people were given the night to think over the report that had been given them by the optimist and the pessimist. And as they thought it all night long, they became more depressed, more despondent, and they felt their case was totally hopeless. They made a decision the next morning to walk by sight and not walk by faith. They made a decision to doubt God and predict gloom. Now, what made them reach that decision? I think that decision was based on another decision. And it's a decision that you and I make, but we keep it secret, and we even try to keep it a secret from ourselves. We just don't think about the reason why we make a pessimistic decision. And that is a decision secretly made by us that we're not going to try anything. We're not going to try anything, first of all, that appears difficult. If it has any appearance of being difficult, I'm not going to try it. I'm not going to try it. The more difficult, the more chance of failure. So I'm not going to try anything that might be difficult. I'm not going to put myself in a position where I might have to admit I am a failure. And secretly we say that, but we don't admit to ourselves. So we make a decision based on this. I'm not going to do anything that appears difficult. Folks, that cuts out a lot of stuff. Secondly, I'm not going to do anything that requires much work. All of us are willing to put out a little bit of labor, but not much. Not much. It's a decision based on I'm not going to try anything that involves risk. Risk of life, risk of reputation, risk of money. I'm not going to try anything that in any way involves risk, that I might could lose anything. And fourthly, I'm not going to do anything that requires a great exercise of blind faith. If I can't be given proof before I do it that I'm going to get what I want, I'm not going to do it. I won't guarantee I don't want to walk by faith. I believe we make many decisions based on those four things right there, and we don't even admit to ourselves. Does it look difficult? Does it require a lot of work? Does it involve some risk? And does it demand blind faith? If it does, a lot of times we say, I'm not going to do it. We become frightened. We become fearful when something is not easy. Huh? That's true. When in school, oftentimes, I would ask, and people would ask me, who is the easy English teacher? Who is the easy history teacher? Now, I don't guess they ask it anymore at school, but when I was there, even in college, you know, there was the rumors, this is the easy one, and this is one you don't want. If you go take this teacher, you're going to face difficulty. You're going to face work. You're going to face risk of an F, and you're going to have to exercise your faith. You may not be that smart. See? So who is the easy teacher? Not only that, but when we went to a class, the teacher said, I never give hard tests. We love that teacher. Everybody likes an easy test. Make it simple, and we like it. If something's not easy, it frightens us. Most of us, I guess, dream of living on Easy Street. None of us have quite reached it yet, but you dream about it. I guess most of us think about making some easy money. And most of you are still looking for the way to make some easy money. We look at a guy that writes one song and sells 5 million copies, making easy money. I haven't written my first one yet. All of us want what's easy. Especially does a pessimist want something that's easy. You want to frighten somebody, go to a pessimist and say, it's going to be difficult, it's going to involve a lot of work, there's going to be some risk involved, and it's going to require a lot of faith. And you've already shut him down. Even you shut him right there. You come there and say, man, it's easy. Anybody can do it. He might try it. But when he tries it and then realizes you fooled him and it's hard and it's difficult and it's risky, he goes away. Mad at you and again depressed and saddened. Now God said to Israel, I'm going to give you the promised land. What he didn't tell them, and they were a crowd of pessimists, I'm not going to give it to you on a silver platter. I'm not going to make it easy for you to get in and get the land. You can get in and you can get the land, but it's not going to be easy. Well, that was a great letdown and a great blow that came to those people that day. The spies came back. They thought they were going to say, there's nobody over there. They're all cowards. They're begging us to come. They want to give us their land. They want to give us their crops. Come on, let's go. They've done built houses for us. They've done furnished them. And they want us to come over there and move in. They're going to grow our crops. They're going to feed our people. You know, that's what they thought. They're going to give us all free chariots and free horses. Hey. That's not the way life is, folks. Not many folks are born with a golden spoon in their mouth. And so, the Lord didn't make it easy. And for pessimists, life has to be easy. But life isn't easy. Okay? To get that land would involve difficulty. Work and risk and danger and faith. You know what method the spies used to convince the people that they shouldn't even try? Not even try. They used the method of complaining. Complaining. They spoke of God's promise and God's command as being an impossibility. The complaint was, God is asking us to do something we can't do. We can't do it. The complaint was, this is not the way we would do it. This is not the way we want it done. If it was us, we'd make it a lot easier than this. This is not what we had in mind when we agreed to follow God out of the land of Egypt. And so they begin to complain. In a sense, after we've read the fine print in the contract, we want out. You know, the natural thing to do when nothing looks easy is to start complaining. Start complaining. And I find today most people thought, think, and talk like the 10 spies and not like Caleb and Joshua. If you listen to most Christians, listen to yourself. Now, I'm not talking just about you. I'm talking about all of us. I'm included now. I said this at the very beginning. Listen to yourself. See what you're saying. Hear yourself. What do you normally hear in conversation with another Christian? To be honest with you, and from myself, I hear much more complaining than I ever do compliments. There's not a week goes by or a Sunday that I don't hear tons of complaints. From myself to myself. From others to me. And there are weeks go by I never hear one compliment of any kind from anyone for anything from myself even to myself. I don't think I'm strange. When Christians meet, what do they share? They share their burdens, they share their problems, but they never share any joy. They never have a good word or encouraging word to say about anyone or anything. It's all complaining. And maybe I'm wrong. But I hear more people dwelling on problems than I ever hear dwelling on solutions. I find I tell myself and I am told more to make me sad than ever told to make me glad. For every glad thing I'm told 100 bad things. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. I don't find a ton of optimistic Christians. If they're out there, they're not talking to me. I don't know where they are. I find there are more bleak pictures painted than bright pictures. I find that what is said by Christians to Christians is more likely to induce fear than it is to create cheer. I also find that most people want to be enthused rather than being the enthuser. How many people do you and I go to with the purpose in mind, I'm going to enthuse you. I'm not going to leave you till I bless you. What is the general subject matter of your thoughts to yourself? What is the general subject matter of your conversations with other Christians? What's most on your mind? That which saddens or that which gladdens? What do you focus most of your attention on, and what do you focus most of the attention on when you're talking with somebody else? Is it something that would depress, or is it something that would encourage and strengthen? Is it something that will weaken my faith, or is it something that will strengthen my faith? I don't know. Maybe I'm all wrong. Like I say, I'm not the one to preach a sermon, I guess. Have we eyes that only can see trouble? The old niggle spiritual over my head, I see trouble in the air. Do you ever see anything besides trouble over your head? You know? If you do, do you ever tell anybody you see something else there? I think sometimes I'm so busy counting my problems and naming them one by one that I never have time to count my blessings. Not even one. Now, I want to be real clear about this. I don't think it's wrong to admit that I've got a problem. I don't think it's wrong to unburden my heart to my Christian fellow people that I've got a burden and I've got a problem. We all have problems. I think it's realism is what I like. Not pessimism and not optimism, but realism. I think we have to face the fact that taking some problems is going to be difficult. It's going to be laborious. It's going to be risky, and it's going to require faith. It's not going to be easy. The devil's not going to roll over and play dead for me. And so I think we need to sometimes, yes, I have a burden. Yes, I am depressed. Yes, I am saved. But I want to say this morning, the Lord's trying to tell me something. If those 10 men would have just balanced the truth, maybe the 12 men should have balanced the truth. The 10 men could have said, it's not going to be easy. There are giants over there. But they could have said, let's go anyway. Let's go anyway. We believe we can do it. And had the other two, Joshua and Caleb, said, these men are right. There are problems ahead. And not everything does look rosy for us. But let's go. I believe if those 10 men would have had a balance. The balance is, you can express the problem if you're also going to express on the same time something to solve the problem. If I'm going to say something that I know will make you say it, I should never do it until I can also know I'm going to say something at the same time to make you glad. Now there's your balance. There's your balance. And I think a lot of times we as Christians don't have the balance. In other words, if I'm going to come to you and unload my discouragement, I have no right to do it unless I can also unload some encouragement along with it. Do you see what I'm saying? If I'm going to come to you with my woe, then I must also come to you with something that balances out, that brings cheer and gladness to your heart. I shouldn't just give you the bitter pill, but I should have a sweet one also. There should be the balance. There should be the balance. Don't say something bad without rehearsing before you say it what you can say afterward it that'll make them glad. Don't leave people just with what's sad and bad. It's all right to leave them with what's sad and bad. It's all right to face honest-to-goodness problems. But leave them also with something to hang on to. Something to put their faith on. Something that's optimistic. Give them something they can be glad about and rejoice over, as well as something that'll make them upset. I believe it's all right to upset as long as you also encourage. All right? If I can never be a source of sunshine in your life, then I should never be a source of rain in your life. Do you follow me? If I can't be a rainbow, then I shouldn't send a storm cloud. If I can't perk you up, then I should not put you down. I believe as Christians, first of all, to yourself, If you're going to dwell on a problem, get yourself a blessing to go along with it. And as you deal with the problem, counterbalance it with something that also brings some cheer to your taste. Give yourself something sweet to taste of as well as something bitter. I don't think you should just ignore your problems. I believe you should confront them. But have you something there in reserve that will leave you with some reason to laugh and to smile? Get yourself a balance. Yes, there are giants in the land, but we can take them. There's no giant as big as our God in the land. We've got a balance now. There will be problems, but we have the God who can solve problems. Get yourself a balance. There's nothing wrong with dealing with those things that are discouraging, so long as you have something that you can add that'll be encouraging. I think so many times we as Christians, we don't have the balance. We don't have the balance. For those who are optimistic and never talk about problems, we say they're not real people. They don't know what's going on. They live in some kind of other world. Sometimes that's true. But I feel like this morning, if I want to leave anything with you, and I'm going to try to practice this, it's not going to be easy. But get your balance. And if I'm going to say something to you that's a burden to me, that's made me sad, then you ought to have the right, well, I'm waiting now, preacher, what are you going to say to Glenn? Don't unload one without unloading the other. I think it's important to do that. Father, we're thankful this day for the privilege we have to face problems. They are real. And they do cause sorrow. Even you wept. Yet, you didn't spend all your time weeping. There must have been in your mind something to balance the sorrow, to bring you joy. And so help us to work, really work on finding thoughts that we can tell ourselves and that we can tell others. As we share the burden, we can share something that will also encourage and strengthen and cheer. May we spread both equally. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.